I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Candidate Donald Trump railed against the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which was being negotiated by the Obama administration and almost a dozen countries. President Trump withdrew from the TPP shortly after taking office, much to the consternation of business leaders, Republicans, and many economists. He said he favored bilateral deals and threatened tariffs on foreign goods from China that responded with threatened tariffs on goods from America. Apparently yesterday, the president told his new economic advisor Larry Kudlow and his trade negotiator Robert Lighthizer to investigate rejoining the TPP. Our guest Alan Blinder writes in his new book, Advice and Dissent, that no subject divides economists from politicians more deeply than international trade. His book is about how elected officials and economists have very different views of the world, which puts them at odds. In fact, he says economists have much less influence over the economy than most people think. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about this divide and how to bridge it. He's the Gordon S. Rentschler Memorial Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He served as a member of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisor. He was also vice chair of the Federal Reserve and joins us once again on Radio Times. Alan Blinder, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Let me ask you, I mean, presidents are allowed to change their mind, but this seems pretty breathtaking, this about-face on TPP. As an economist, what do you make of this?
Well, I think I make of it, thank heaven for small favors. As you mentioned, almost all of us thought it was a mistake to withdraw from the TPP. I should say parenthetically, it's not as big a deal as many people make it out to be, but it's a positive, certainly a positive. So why walk away from it? To your point about influence of economists, You may recall that he did this way before he had any economists to talk in his ear. He didn't have anybody. He just walked away from it, ignoring, among other things, that it was probably our best shot to move China on the issue we really need to move them on, which is not the bilateral trade imbalance, but intellectual property rights. There is a lot in the TPP pushed in by the United States on intellectual property rights, and China would have been on the outs. And if they wanted to get on the ins, which they would have eventually and maybe quickly, they'd have to agree to these things.
Well, let me talk more broadly, not just about the TPP, but trade deals in particular, mm-hmm. because you say that economists and elected officials look at them very differently. Largely speaking, as you said, economists are in favor of trade deals, but they don't necessarily understand that there are people that do lose out under a trade deal, and perhaps economists can be a little more warm-hearted to those people.
I think absolutely. So I think it's not that economists don't understand this, is that they give it short shrift, that they don't pay attention to it. It's like it's a footnote or something. But if you take a steel worker in western Pennsylvania who loses his job because of a trade agreement, by the way, or maybe not because of a trade agreement,
right.
In any case, loses his job, that's not a little deal to him. It's not a little deal to his family. And it's not going to be a little deal to his congressman or congresswoman.
Is that because economists generally are math people and elected officials have to think about their constituents and getting reelected?
Yeah, well, sort of. Yeah, I put it a little differently in the book, that they use a kind of different arithmetic, but it's consistent exactly with what you said. We sort of add up the pluses and the minuses, and if it all adds up to plus, we're probably going to be favorably disposed to it. But politicians put on a lot of weighting. It's not just adding pluses and minuses. So one thing that matters a lot is the geography.
Right.
So maybe this is good for the whole country, but it's not good for my district. That matters a lot, and it's not crazy that it matters a lot. The other thing, which is, you know, not so lovely but very real, is that things that move voters to political action really matter, and things that don't matter in the world of politics. So it's very common in a trade agreement that you have a small number of big losers, like some factories may get shuttered and some industries may be severely damaged, and millions and millions of small winners that basically wind up paying less at Walmart for a lot of things that they buy. So if you just apply ordinary arithmetic, it's easy to score it a plus. But if you weight this by political influence, those millions of consumers are either not going to know that their lower prices had anything to do with the trade agreement, or even if they do, the fact that it saved them $3 a year, it is not going to move them to political action.
But do you think then economists should use different languages, different words, yeah, rather, or talk about these, if we're talking about trade deals, to talk about it in a way that kind of humanizes the subject?
Absolutely both. We need to use different language. We need to, I jokingly say to my fellow economists, I'm on a campaign to ban the phrase transition costs from the language.
That's a phrase I have never used in my life, I have to say, Alan Blank.
Good. Good.
I don't even know what it means.
Well, economists use it all the time. Go back to my steel worker. They say, well, he lost his job in Western Pennsylvania, but he'll get another one.
Right.
So this is just, and he will. You know, it's mostly right. He will get another one, but there may be a rocky road between here and there. And calling that a transition cost, thereby belittling it, is not a good way to communicate with ordinary people, or more germane to what we're talking about, the politicians that represent them. And second, to your second point, absolutely, we tend to forget too much the human face to this. These are real people having real problems. And I think I don't put this blame mostly on the doorstep of economists, but much more on the doorstep of Democratic politicians. Had we done a better job of that, Donald Trump might not have got elected in 2016. He saw something that a lot of other people didn't.
Well, and I do. It's hard not to talk about the president when having this kind of conversation. But I should say to our listeners, the book is not about President Trump,
no.
But it's also about how economists and elected officials do see the world differently. You have a theory. It's called the lamppost theory. What is
right.
that?
So the lamppost theory, which is demonstrated in many ways in this book, is that politicians use economics the way a drunk uses a lamppost. For support, not for illumination. So most of them don't want to hear a lot of economic theory, a lot of economic analysis, a lot of economic fact. What they'd like to do, though Trump cares about this much less than normal politicians, is trot out some economists to say nice things about the conclusions they've already reached on political grounds.
Is that because they're about getting reelected? And
re-elected.
Obviously economists don't have to think about that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe not very helpful in that.
You have something called, you actually kind of update Murphy's Law for economic policy. I'll read it here. Mm-hmm. Speaking to what you just said, economists have the least influence on policy where they know the most and are most agreed. They have the most influence on policy where they know the least and disagree most vehemently. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Let me start with the latter and then go back to the former, which is more important, I think. The field that I'm in is called macroeconomics, about managing the national economy. It's about what the Federal Reserve does and things like that. There are lots of disagreements about that, huge uncertainties about that. And yet economics in general and economists, a number of economists in particular, have enormous influence on what the nation actually does about things like that. Jay Powell, who just assumed the chairmanship, is the first non-economist to sit in the chair in a very, very long time.
He's a banker, right?
He was an investment banker originally, yes. Actually, I think he went to law school. I'm not sure he ever practiced law. Mm. But he's not an economist for sure. On the other side, two great examples. One we were talking about a moment ago, which is trade. I mean, economists are very much agreed about trade. I think they have a pretty good understanding about it. And if you asked 100 economists chosen at random about a particular trade issue, I think you get an overwhelming opinion on one side or the other, depending on what you were asking. Another even better example is how to deal with climate change and how to deal with pollution in general, though the issue of the day is climate change. I often joke that 101 out of 100 economists will favor a carbon tax. And if you take this to the political world, 999 out of 1,000 politicians will be against it.
Is that because it has the word tax in it?
Yes, I think so.
So is it a matter of rebranding that somehow?
Well, maybe. You may remember that John McCain and, God, I'm forgetting, another Democratic senator, maybe back, it might have been Joe Lieberman, it was back a while, advocated something called cap and trade instead. So cap and trade is a system, it's sort of like a tax, but you don't have to use the T word. It's that you have to purchase a permit if you want to emit, say, in this case, carbon. And those permits become tradable, and therefore they get a market price. So you have to pay the market price, which is analogous to paying a tax, but you don't use the T word. So that helped a little. It actually got a bill introduced in the Senate. I'm not sure it ever made it to the House, but it didn't help that much.
Is it the politicians, they don't want to hear economic advice that's going to hurt them politically,
yeah,
or they don't understand economics? And economics is, you know, there have been some errors predicting,
yes,
what's going to happen. I mean, economists are fallible like the rest of us. What's at play here?
Yeah, I think it's both, but I'd put a bigger weight on the first, about not wanting to do things that are politically risky, I would say. You know, you said politically hurtful, which is right. But a lot of these politicians just don't want to take any chances. And they may hear these 101 out of 100 economists say, it'll be great with a carbon tax after an initial adjustment period. And they say, oh boy, in the initial adjustment period, I lose my seat in Congress. So, but there is some of the other. I'm not understanding basic economics. If you come back to trade, I'm not sure I'd want to give a test like I give to my Princeton Economics 101 students to members of Congress. I'm not sure that the grades would be that great.
And is that just because they took different classes when they were in college?
They come from a different world. Absolutely. They come from different walks of life. They may have expertise in other things. It's not like the one and only thing you should know to serve in Congress is economics. So some of them may be good at it. Some of them are good at it. Some of them are very bad at it, and they may be good at other things. And I must say, these days especially, some of them, I don't know what's going through their heads.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but is this something new that you're talking about, this divide between economists and politicians?
No, I don't think it's new at all. I say early in the book that when I actually planned to write this book and started initial scribbles, I never imagined that Donald Trump would ever be president of the United States. So he just made it worse. What you're seeing with Trump is a very exaggerated version of the lamppost theory that almost elides the desire for support. So the support part is that, as I said before, typical politicians like to trot out economists to say how wonderful the political ideas are. Trump doesn't seem to care about that. You know, they come out of his great brain, and he doesn't care about anybody else.
Well, that's Alan Blinder, our guest on Radio Times today, joining us from the studios of Princeton University, where he's a professor. He's got a new book. It's called Advice and Dissent: Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alan Blinder. He's up at Princeton, where he's a professor. And again, we're talking about his new book, Advice and Dissent: Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Let me play just a very short clip. This is President Trump speaking in the Rose Garden yesterday.
And we're going to discuss our massive tax cuts that are growing paychecks all over our country. They're creating jobs and expanding the American dream, just like we said would happen. That's the way it's happened.
Alan Blinder, looking at the tax bill, the tax cuts, it's been, a month or two? Is that too soon to know whether they're working or not?
It's definitely too soon to know by a lot. Especially the corporate tax provision. The biggest deal in terms of changing the nature of the tax code were on the corporate side. And, you know, I read it. There was a story in the paper just this morning that there's still a turf war going on between the OMB and the Treasury in terms of getting out the nitty-gritty details. So if you're running a business and asking your accountant detailed things about the new tax law, your accountant is probably saying, I don't know. I'm waiting to hear from the Treasury. So that's just one among many reasons why it's too soon to tell. The other reason that contributes to the too, or the other factor contributes to the too soon to tell, is that this tax cut is blowing up the budget deficit. Mm. You may remember that the Republicans thought budget deficits were horrible when Obama was president, and now they don't. Now they think they're wonderful, or they ignore them, or whatever. But in any case, the fact is that whether you like the tax cut or not, it's going to contribute to larger budget deficits. And larger budget deficits, as has been said many times, are kind of like termites in the basement. They eat away things really slowly, and you may not notice them for a number of years until the foundation starts crumbling.
Well, I think
we're a long way from that.
The projection is something like adding $1 trillion to the debt in the year 2020. That's just a couple of years away.
Yeah.
How big is our debt? I've lost track of that, to be honest with
well,
you.
Well, it's easy to lose track of it because a lot of people use a $20 trillion number,
right,
which is exaggerated because it ignores the fact that about 40%, I don't know the exact number, of that debt is owned inside the government. So the two biggest owners are the Social Security Trust Fund and the Federal Reserve, but there are also some other owners. So that's like your left hand owing to your right hand, and when you aggregate to your whole self, you want to net that out. So if you do that, you come to a number that's a ballpark $13 trillion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that, looking at the size of our economy, is that a manageable number?
It is. So the size of our economy now is about $19 trillion. So I'm doing very round numbers here. But if I had the right numbers, I happen to know this number. The net debt, as we call it, netting out what the government owes itself, is about 78% of GDP. So if you compare that with our history, it's kind of high. We are much higher after World War II. But then it came down to a low, I think, if I remember correctly, in the 70s to about 22% or 24% of GDP, and now we're up to 78. That's a lot. The projections that you just alluded to have us going up to 100% of GDP in a few years. That's way higher than we have experienced since the Second World War, and getting high enough that you start, I think it's reasonable to start worrying about it.
Well, and I'm assuming, even broadly speaking, macroeconomics, there's good debt and bad debt. Just like, you know, if you invest in a college education, hopefully, and you go into debt, hopefully that's a good investment, and the money pays off. And if you just, you know, paying off your gambling debts, that's something entirely different. Is that also true with our larger economy?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, in the terms you're using, almost all of this is bad debt. So what would be good debt?
Taking up your
example, and there's been a lot of talk about this but no action. Suppose we floated debt issues, as states and localities do regularly, to finance, say, infrastructure spending. Build roads, build bridges, repair train stations. I use Penn Station in New York a lot. It's not too good. 30th Street looks a lot better. Tunnels, schools, things like that. To the extent we use it for those kinds of purposes, there's a return on the investment. So you borrow money and you earn a return. To the extent that we just use it to finance higher standards of consumption, spending, there's no return whatsoever. So there is that good debt, bad debt. The other important aspect of it is timing. There are good times to float more debt and bad times to float more debt. So what's a good time? When you're in a recession, the economy needs a boost from anywhere. And one way to give it a boost is for the government to spend more money or to give people tax cuts. And we did that in 2009-10. It was extremely appropriate fiscal policy. We're sitting now with about a 4% unemployment rate, which most economists think is either at full employment or really beyond full employment. This is not the kind of circumstance in which you want to run big budget deficits.
Does it drive up inflation if you're giving people more money?
Yeah, it first drives up interest rates, and second drives up inflation. So we've definitely not seen the latter. And up to now, we haven't seen too much of the up to now, it hasn't driven interest rates up very much and hasn't driven inflation up at all. But as we look out to the future, those are the worries.
You have a whole – you write a lot in this book, actually, about the income gap, the inequality gap in this country. I do want to spend a fair amount of time talking about that because it seems like it is so critical. But when you look at this tax bill that was passed, does that exacerbate that gap?
It certainly looks that way to almost everybody. There are some partisans on the pro-tax cut side that try to deny that. But if you look at what was actually done big cuts in the corporate income tax, as I mentioned before, the biggest benefit. Now, it is true that some of that will trickle down to the workers. Mm-hmm. They will get some of the benefit. But the lion's share of that will go to the shareholders. And it's happening already with share buybacks and dividends and things like that. So that was a very big hunk of the tax cut. The top bracket rate got cut again. For a long time on iterations of this bill, that wasn't happening, even though Republicans always do it. But sort of at the last minute, that came in to the bill. There's a tax benefit. This, by the way, is one of those things that the regulations are still awaited for closely held businesses that are not corporations, pass-through entities. There was a doubling of the estate tax exemption. It was already high. It was so high already before this bill that only 0.2% of decedents owed any estate tax. Now that number is much less. So it goes on and on that way. There were a few things cutting in the other direction, but I think there's very little doubt that this is, if not the most, but among the most regressive tax cuts ever enacted by Congress.
I'm looking at a headline from the Washington Post. This is a headline. The richest Americans get a $33,000 tax break under the GOP tax plan. The poorest get $40. Perhaps just underscoring what you just said there. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Alan Blinder joining us from the studios of Princeton University, where he is a professor. And again, he's got a new book called Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, a number of different ways to join our conversation. Let me get Roger from Ardmore to join us. Roger, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Terry.
It's Marty, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It has happened before, Roger. Not a worry.
the main engine of the wealth divide is the so-called Federal Reserve Bank. Of course, it's not federal. There's no reserve. It's not a bank. But they are constantly acting to prop up even fraudulently derived asset prices, stock prices, housing prices. And they do that by even having a target for inflation, even though their mandate is for price stability. They have a 2% per year inflation card, which is achieved through currency debasement. And, of course, the workers earn their money in currency. The CEOs, CFOs, they earn their wages in stock options, which are being propped up. So the seemingly relentless and increasing wealth divide is really done by a conduit being the so-called Federal Reserve Bank.
Well, you know, Roger, I appreciate the call, and you called the right place because our guest was a vice chair of the Federal Reserve. What do you say back to Roger?
Okay, I take a few issues with Roger. First of all, on the name, it is federal. It's part of the national government. It even has a federal structure because there are 12 district banks around the country, including one in Philadelphia. It is reserve because the banks keep their reserves there, and it is a bank. So it is Federal Reserve Bank. I really would like to take issue that this is done in any way fraudulently. Everything that's done at the Fed is above the board. It's published. You know exactly what its portfolio is. Nothing is hidden. Now, by the way, all of this doesn't mean to say the Fed has never, ever made a mistake. I certainly would never claim that. But there's nothing fraudulent about it whatsoever. It buys and sells assets to do monetary policy. That's what it has always done since the 1920s, and that's what it still does now. To get us out of the crisis, and the Fed helped a lot on that, it had to buy massive amounts, much more than it ever bought before, and that has raised the number of eyebrows, but that was just doing what the Fed does on a much grander scale. And finally, to this question, and Roger's not the only person that thinks the Fed should be shooting for zero inflation, measured inflation, rather than 2% measured inflation, which is what they do shoot for. So that's a debatable issue,
sure.
What should be the Fed's target. But I just want to say two things about that. I could go on and on. When I talk to my students at Princeton, I go on for hours about this.
You can't do that on Radio Time.
No. I'm going to go on for only a few seconds. First of all the official measurements of inflation, all economists agree, are upwardly biased. That is, the number that they flash is higher than the actual inflation for a whole number of reasons. That's why I go on for hours on this. Secondly, so that's a reason to post a target for measured inflation that's bigger than zero. Secondly, if your inflation target is very low and the real interest rate is very low, you're working in a very low interest rate environment, so that if a recession hits and the Fed tries to combat that by lowering interest rates, it doesn't have very far it can go.
Right.
So if you start with a 2% inflation target, it gives you a little bit more room.
I do want to ask you, just because we were talking about the Federal Reserve and the 2008 financial crisis, and one of your criticisms was, and perhaps this is more about Congress and the Federal Reserve, but that banks were rescued, but not homeowners and smaller banks also did not get that same kind of rescue package.
Yes. Well, so many smaller banks actually did, but it was the homeowners where the government fell down. And you're 100% right, Marty, that is a criticism I voiced at the time and I've voiced ever since, and I feel it very strongly. But it was not the Federal Reserve's business to go bailing out homeowners. It was the political government's business to do that. And they did it very half-heartedly, very poorly, and very late, much, much too little to help the underwater homeowners relative to what was done to help the potentially underwater banks, that to make sure they don't go underwater.
Would we be in better shape, we meaning the United States broadly speaking, if we had done more for homeowners?
Oh, I think so. And I think especially, this is already 2018, so this is well in the rearview mirror. I think the more germane point, very much related to what you said, is we would have been in better shape in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, et cetera, if we had gotten over this underwater homeowners problem faster than we did. By now, it's mostly in the rearview mirror.
A question from John from Downingtown. He says, if the economy was good at the end of Obama's 8 years, why didn't we pay back any of the debt? Can you answer that?
Yes. Part of the answer is it wasn't that good. It was good, but not the only time in modern history we've paid down some of our debt was the last few years of the Clinton administration, where the economy was really super, super, super good, growing over 4% annualized. So that's one part of it. Secondly, the fiscal stimulus package that came in early in the Obama presidency, so 2009, 2010, a little bit in 2011, ballooned the deficit for good reasons, by the way. But in any case, ballooned the deficit to very large numbers, some ballpark 10% of GDP. That's a gigantic number for the deficit compared to GDP. The good news is that both by some policy initiatives, but especially a stronger economy, that got down by the end of the Obama years to under 3% of GDP. I don't remember the exact number, 2.8 or something like that. So think of that as progress. We went from 10% of GDP to 3% of a GDP. If we had started at 5% of GDP and had the same amount of progress, it would have been minus 2% of GDP. That is to say, a surplus which starts to pay down the deficit. But when you start from 10% of GDP, it's pretty hard to get to a position where you're paying down deficit.
There was a I think it's called Gallup Share Care Wellbeing Index. It looked at how Americans feel about living in this country, their sense of purpose, their social relationships, financial security, health, their connectedness to the economy. I'm quoting from the Washington Post. Do you think economists should be more interested in a well-being index when talking about the economy in this country?
Well, sort of. So I'm of two minds on that. To some extent, surely yes. That it's not in the sense that your income is not the only thing that matters to you. The no part of it, the reason I'm of two minds, is the principle of comparative advantage. We're not the experts on sociology, anthropology, psychology, and so on. We're the experts on the economic part of life. And there's a case that we economists should stick to our knitting.
Stick to the numbers as opposed to trying to get inside the heads of how – because I think for people, obviously, it's how you experience the economy that makes you feel either good or bad about the country that we live in.
I agree 100%. I'm just not so sure that I and my economic colleagues are so good at doing that.
Let's take a very short break. Let me just read a couple of comments here before we do that. This is going back to our trade discussion. Trump said he would relook at trade pact because he was in front of a group representing farmers' interests. Yeah. Trump always says what the audience wants to hear. A tweet, a great point that if money from tax cuts isn't targeted to things that pay back, then the deficit is a problem. An email from Sally, how do we get to the place where President George W. Bush could use the phrase jobless recovery as a positive without widespread pushback? Lots that we're talking about on Radio Times today with our guest Alan Blinder, again a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He was a member of President Clinton's Council on Economic Advisors. He was also a vice chair of the Federal Reserve, and he's got a new book, Advice and Dissent: Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Much more to talk about after this short break. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Alan Blinder is our guest. He's a professor at Princeton University, a former vice chair of the Federal Reserve, and the author of a new book called Advice and Dissent about politics and economics and how they sometimes don't mix, kind of like oil and water. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Rose from Flemington to join us on Radio Times. Rose, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're
welcome.
I'm
so pleased that you're having this show today.
Great.
And I would like to come from a different angle as a disabled person since 96, and I'm blind. And I'm wondering if the guest would comment on the idea that if climate change is non-existent, and, you know, do we have to have dams collapse? Is that cheaper? Do we have some sort of formulary where all those people won't be compensated for very little money? And as far as the disabled and their entitlements, you know, that's going to be the killing ground. And I'm wondering if we have to worry that we're going to be the first in line.
Well, I sure hope not, Rose. And I appreciate the call into Radio Times. And I think there is, Alan Blinder, just a lot of worry about our future.
There definitely is, and climate change is one part of that. Obviously, the White House is not worrying enough about that. It is the case that certain people are going to be much more vulnerable to the harm from climate change if we don't do more about it than we're doing it, than others. A few generalizations. Rich people will be able to cope with this better than poor people. That's true of anything, whatever the this is. Disease, rain, you know, you name it, the rich can cope with it better than the poor always. The healthy, to Rose's point, the healthy better than the people that have health difficulties. And in this particular instance, climate change, people who live away from water are going to be better off than people who live near the water. The ocean's rise is one of the most worrisome aspects of climate change. And I live in the center of New Jersey, We're not very close to the ocean, but a lot of New Jersey is right on the ocean. And those people, not Flemington, by the way,
no,
but those people are much more exposed to the problem than the people who live inland.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about economists being having to measure things, and with sea level rise, that is measurable. I mean, that's,
yes,
you know, you can actually see it. Let me pick up on something, and this goes back to this income divide that you write about, and you have a couple of ideas about what to do about it: a higher minimum wage, more profit sharing, strengthening unions, vocational training and apprenticeships, occupational licensure, K through 12 education, pre-K education. If we invested more in that, and even, as I think, as you say, sort of marrying a social worker with an economist, that would pay off for us?
I think so. Now, not everything. People can come up with dreamy schemes that are unlikely to have high payoffs. I tried to tick off on the list in the book, and you named several of them, the things that look to me, based on the evidence, and it's not mostly evidence that I ferreted out, it's many people working on these things, to have a very strong payoff. So my favorite policy on that whole list is pre-K, if you want to call it education. I'm not sure you call what you do with three-year-olds education, but it's education of a sort. The evidence is overwhelming that this turns back substantial social benefits. The kids that get quality pre-K education do better in K through 12. They perform better in the job market. They're less likely to engage in criminal activity and so on and so forth. And the returns are enormous. But here's the thing, mm-hmm. and I think it's the main explanation for why we don't do more of this. The benefits are far in the future. The costs are up front, right? So it costs something to give quality pre-K education to, say, everybody. And by the way, it's not the problem for people. My children are a lot older than that. My grandchildren, we take care of them. The upper middle class and the upper classes take care of them. It's the people in the lower middle classes and the poor people that don't have the means to do that. Society doesn't pick up the bill the way we should because the costs come up front. And if you think of when do the benefits really mm-hmm. from the pre-K education start accruing, it's sort of after these kids pass 18 and start entering the labor force and become productive citizens and earn more. That's a long time to wait in politics.
Is there any way to reverse that? I'm trying to imagine.
Reverse the timing. I don't think so for right. that. But there are others. I talk about the following in the book. There are a number of places, important policy issues, and I'll come. And one of them is climate change, by the way, where it is possible to reverse it and have the goodies come up front and the baddies come later. So I talked before about all economists wanting to see a carbon tax as a palliative, something to improve reduce the dangers of climate change. The best way to do that, by the way, is to introduce it at really, really low levels at first and then let it ramp up. So by dint of that, you postpone the pain. The pain is the taxes. Nobody's going to pay much in taxes for the first 1, 2, 3, maybe 5, maybe more years, and then it'll ramp up. But in the meantime, you're well on the road to mitigating climate damage.
Mm, interesting. Let me get Harry from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Harry. Thanks for taking my call. My
sure.
question is, what can we do to promote investment for employment for Americans? Since NAFTA, you know, tens of thousands of good-paying jobs were also industry after industry just lopped off 10,000-15,000 jobs. And those good-paying jobs have never been replaced. And the problem is you can't describe a complex system with simple arithmetic and say, well, you lost a job, but you saved $3 at Walmart. Now, we had the behaviorist try to describe human nature with simple arithmetic. It didn't work. And you can't do that with economics either and say, okay, well, tens of thousands of people lost good-paying jobs, but it's okay because you saved $3 at Walmart. So what can we do to build employment for Americans?
It's a good question, Harry. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alan Blinder, go ahead.
So we can do a lot of things. I would start with the maintenance of full employment, which we failed at for many, many years, but we're doing quite well now. when people look for jobs in a 4% unemployment economy. Now, by the way, that's not true in every locale in America, but it's the national average. They're a lot easier to find than when people are looking for jobs in an 8% unemployment economy. That's the most important thing on the list. Secondly, something Marty mentioned briefly when she was ticking off things that could reduce inequality. I think we do a very poor job of, in the educational system, for people that don't go to college or don't finish college. There are a lot of jobs requiring skilled labor that can't be outsourced to foreign countries and where people can earn very nice livings. So I'm talking about electricians, plumbers, roofers, carpenters, repair people that come and fix devices that you have in the house that break down, and on and on and on. I think it's only a slight exaggeration to say we as a society ignore such people. If you compare us to the Germans, say, that have apprenticeship programs all over the place for the non-college bound students, and they naturally get placed into good jobs when they graduate, it's sad that we do so little of this and they do so much. It's not like this is pie in the sky. And by the way, I picked Germany as probably the outstanding country. But if you sort of make a league table of how much does each country spend on apprenticeships and vocational training, we're basically at the bottom.
Wow.
It's not just that we're worse than Germany. We're worse than Canada. We're worse than Australia. We're worse than everybody.
Harry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation talking with economist Alan Blinder. Alan, do you think we pay too much attention to the stock market, the ups and downs, especially that have been going on in the last couple of months?
Yeah, way too much. You may have noticed that the President Trump has stopped talking about it. We were hearing about it all the time when it goes up. Stock markets go up and stock markets go down. And I don't want to overstate this because they are tethered to the fundamentals of the economy. When the economy is doing better, the stock market's doing better, and conversely. But they're loosely tethered. The stock market can fly off on tangents in a plus direction or a minus direction, and frequently does. Example of that, the great economist Paul Samuelson, one of my teachers of many, many decades ago, famously said that the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. So
it's very reactive. It's very reactive, or maybe overreactive.
It's overreactive. I often put it somewhat differently than Samuelson did, but it's totally consonant, which is that the stock markets and other financial markets, but the stock market's the biggest example, generally get the direction right and exaggerate the magnitude by a factor between 3 and 10. So the 10 is when the market's really going kaplooey. The 3 is when it's calm, but it's always reacting too much.
What do you make of the fact, and it's calmed down a bit, but what do you make of the fact that President Trump went after Amazon, and this is an American company. It has its critics. I'm not saying there isn't a reason to criticize some of what Amazon does or doesn't do, but the fact that you have the President of the United States being so outspokenly critical of this country, and look what happened to the stock market.
Yeah, I think it's very simple, actually. Jeff Bezos bought as a hobby, it's a very small part of his gigantic empire, the Washington Post, and has infused money into the Washington Post. So that prevented what otherwise probably would have been a contraction of their news coverage. And the Washington Post has been doing a fantastic job, along with the New York Times, by the way. He calls that the failing New York Times, as you know, exposing scandals and various other malfeasances in the Trump administration. That's why. I don't think he got this from his son, Barron. I'm sure Barron's using Amazon all the time.
like the rest of us, right?
Like the rest of us, yeah.
If you could get a room of economists like mine, well, even as you seem to be saying, economists generally agree on a lot of things, but could lock them in a room somewhere and reform, truly reform our tax system, what would it look like? Yep.
Well, I think, first of all, it would be a lot simpler. That would be the main thing. I think it would likely, this would be a point of contention, which I think could be worked out, but it would likely shift the burden of taxes a bit more to consumption than the current system. But the current system does that. This is really more about simplicity. The current system does that in a clumsy way. We have umpteen tax provisions that favor savings in various and sundry ways. They interact sometimes in silly ways. That could all be cleaned up. We have definitions of dependents or children. There must be 12 different ones depending on what corner of the tax code you're looking at. I think the earned income tax credit would surely be made more generous, especially for people that don't have children.
Hmm.
You know, we think of that as a subsidy for working for relatively low, though not necessarily impoverished, people. And it is, but it really only applies to people that have children. Childless people get next to nothing from this. That could be fixed and should be fixed easily. And you know, it goes on and on and on like that. More simple, fairer. You know, the tax code in terms of the number of pages could be shrunk dramatically.
How many pages is it?
Thousands? I don't know. It's many thousands, and they're now writing. I alluded to this before. The fight between the Treasury and the OMB is about adding, I don't know, another couple of thousand pages probably to the, I don't know how many, to the tax code.
You say the 1986 tax plan under Ronald Reagan, that was an example of when, largely speaking, when economists and politicians came together.
Yeah. It was very dramatic, and it was a wonderful – I think it's the best tax bill ever passed the Congress, and many economists think that. But it was 30 years ago. But if you think back to what was done now, the word tax reform gets kicked around a lot. I saw a film – a video clip just the other day of somebody raising – this was some months back – tax reform to Trump. And he said, never mind tax reform, it's tax cuts. That was an honest statement. So under the guise of tax reform, what we really got was not very much reform. We got a little, but not very much. We got tax cuts. What happened in 1986 was not a tax cut. It was the kind of thing I was speaking about before. Drastic simplification of the tax code, closing numerous loopholes, and then using the revenue from that loophole closing to lower rates for everybody.
Hmm.
So tax rates went down a lot. But tax revenues did not go down. They were not supposed to go down. That was not the design of the tax bill. It was supposed to be revenue neutral, and approximately it was. So that means it didn't add anything to the deficit. It added to the efficiency of the economy because these loopholes, in addition to creating unfairness, also create inefficiencies as people try to take advantage of tax loopholes. And then it made the tax code a lot fairer.
We're going to end on that note. Alan Blinder, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. Joined us from the studios of Princeton University. And again, he's got a new book, Advice and Dissent, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.